You're listening to the Plus Music Podcast with Brian and Nick, where we're talking to artists about what it's like to get your music heard in the ever-changing music industry, how it is to use tools like social media and other platforms as an independent artist in a changing music business. Today we sit down with investor, entrepreneur, and music business advisor, Daniel Wiseman. Daniel joins us from his Nashville offices and talks about his early beginnings working with Roc Nation and helping discover artists like Wale, Mike Posner, and Big Sean, how the music business continues to adapt, and how focusing on quality and professionalism is what makes an artist win today. Here's more from Daniel now. Welcome to the Plus Music Podcast. We're sitting down today with Vice President of the Nashville Office of Bernstein Private Wealth Management, an entrepreneur and a music industry advisor, Daniel Wiseman. Dan, welcome to the show. Here's a couple of things we learned about you before we jump into the interview here. We know that you spent over a decade as an entrepreneur and a trusted advisor in the music industry, most recently as an executive artist manager at Roc Nation. You co-founded a luxury shoe brand called Buscemi, and as well, you sold the One White Charlie's to Unilever in 2016. You produced a short film, Too Legit, starring Zoe Kravitz, selected for the 2016 Sundance Film Festival. And you're a Grammy voting member, as well as a SAG-AFTRA member, a Billboard 30 Under 30 honoree, and a 2011 Grammy Board governor, as well as Grammy nominee. We're just scratching the tip of the iceberg of what you've accomplished. We want to hear more. Welcome to the show, Daniel Wiseman.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. Why don't we just start out with how you got into the music business way back when, and what got you there, and was that a winding road, or did you go straight there?
I don't know if there's a straight road to get in the music business, but I was the kid that always wanted to know what the samples were, who the producers were. I'd read album booklets religiously, and I developed a pretty eclectic musical taste back in the mid '90s, growing up in Southern California, Los Angeles. Went off to the boarding school in Boston, got some turntables when I was in high school, started DJing. And then when I went to college at Emory in Atlanta, I started DJing at clubs down there and started promoting parties. And a young man named Scooter Braun was a classmate of mine, and he and I were business partners in college and threw parties in Atlanta and made way too much money for college kids. I left that all behind to go out to LA after college to work in the mailroom at United Talent Agency. Never occurred to me to pursue a career in the music business. After about a year at UTA, I decided I hated reading scripts. I went to DC for a weekend to visit another friend from Emory. And I just asked him, hey, any up and coming rappers in DC that I should know about? And he's like, oh, you got to check out this guy, Wale. And I checked him out and I was like, man, this guy's really good. He's speaking my language, like really into sneakers, et cetera. I sent him a message on MySpace, if you remember what that is.
Oh, yeah.
And managed to finagle a meeting with him when he was coming out to LA to sort of network and whatnot, and basically convinced him on my lunch break from being an assistant at a law firm at that point to let me be his manager.
Wow. Very cool.
So you struck gold kind of from the beginning, or was that kind of your first real artist representation that worked out, or did you kind of...
No, that was my first client.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, it was a long road once we started working together before, he really hit critical acclaim and started, really making money. But, I believed in him from the get, and I gave him a chance and he gave me a chance, and I'm forever grateful to him for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
That's really cool.
And then from there, did you pick up more artists to add to your roster, or where'd you go from
there? Yeah, pretty much I have my alma mater, Emory, to thank for basically all of my success in the music business. Another friend of mine at Emory who ended up in the music business was working at Cornerstone, the Fader at the time, and told me about a friend of his who was in a fraternity at Duke University and said, there's this kid who's a freshman, or maybe he's a sophomore at the time, who makes beats. Can you send these to Wale? And my friend, Matt Graham, who now manages Midland and now actually manages Wale, I introduced them. He sent me beats and from this kid, and I listened to him. I'm like, wow, this kid's amazing. He's also got a really unique voice. And that was Mike Posner. And I started instant messaging with him, which doesn't exist anymore.
I
we built a rapport, and I gave him the suggestion to make a mixtape. And we found a hack to get it on iTunes through iTunes U, and it quickly shot to number one on iTunes. And all of a sudden everyone's like, who is Mike Posner? And through Mike, I met Big Sean, another rapper who's from Detroit, where Mike knew him from. And we started working together. And, you know, later on, another friend of mine from Emory put me on to an indie rock band in LA. They had about 6,000 followers on Facebook, and he played this song called Safe and Sound for me. And I said, this is a massive hit. I just need to figure out how to make it a hit. And that was Capital Cities. And
Capital Cities, yeah. That's it.
And yesterday, I actually just yesterday got notification from the RIAA that Safe and Sound is officially 6 times platinum, and their album certified gold and platinum.
Wow.
Yeah. Huge.
That's just an amazing story. And, you know, they almost seem like folklore, you know, just started getting into the management and hit it big, you know, but it's really cool that it happens. What would you say? So like, tell me, how did you get to be an executive artist at Roc Nation and get set up in that camp?
When they first formed, a guy named Rich Kleiman, who now manages Kevin Durant, and another guy named John Manili, who at the time was Jay-Z's manager, Rich had signed Wale to Mark Ronson's record company, because Rich was also managing Mark Ronson at the time. And there was an opportunity for John Manili, who, you know, is one of the greatest managers, I think, of all time, to come in and work on Wale with me. And I saw it as a great opportunity to learn from somebody great. And I saw it as a great opportunity for Wale to get to the next level. So I co-managed him with Roc Nation for a while. Then Mike Posner took off, and that kind of took up all my time. Wale and I amicably parted ways. And then a number of years later, Wale asked me to come work with him again. And so I joined Roc Nation at the end of 2013.
Very cool.
Interesting. So what were there any, for the musicians out there listening, were there any key decisions that you made, you and your artists made together, that made big differences?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a few that stick out. For Wale at the time, 2006, very similar era to what we're in now in terms of hip hop. I think we're in the second era of ringtone rap, you know, via TikTok. And at the time, if you didn't have a dance or a ringtone that was popping, it was kind of like, good luck being a rapper. And our notion was, let's go after the internet. And that sounds absolutely insane right now, because it's like, okay, so duh. But in 2006, the notion of building a fan base on the internet was very foreign to people. Yeah. And we made the promise to ourselves to not chase radio, not chase trends, and build a wide, diverse fan base globally. And it worked out. Later on, managing Posner, we hired an independent radio promoter to work Cooler Than Me to radio very early on. The label didn't think that was the first single, and we did. So we hired a promoter to work the record, and it ended up, you know, starting to chart. And then the label got on board with that being the first single. Similarly with Big Sean, we did the same thing with his first single, My Last. And similarly with Capital Cities, we did the same thing with Safe and Sound. Every label turned them down. Every publisher turned them down. I hired Dale Canone and Darren Eggleston from Intune Music to work Safe and Sound to alternative radio. It was a lot of money at the time, but we really believed in the song, and the song started charting. And by the time we ended up doing deals with Sony Publishing and Capital, we had already recouped on our investment from the promotion.
Fantastic.
And so, you know, like, you don't have to necessarily answer this, but, you know, a lot of artists think like, how do I get to the, you know, Capital, be able to hire those folks that I would need to break through for us. Mm-hmm. Did you guys go out and raise capital, or you just bring it from in-house?
We just brought it from in-house. The guys had been, you know,
making money,
relatively successful doing syncs and, you know, playing some shows here and there. I offered to help capitalize it, but they, you know, they ended up doing it themselves, and, you know, they really just took a bet on themselves, and that expenditure right there, I mean, it really changed their lives, because it gave us the leverage to negotiate terms back in 2012, you know, via a 50-50 joint venture with Capital, that nobody was getting a deal like that in 2012, and certainly not a new artist. It's mm-hmm. more commonplace now, but in 2012, it was really unheard of.
Yeah, they were doing, that was the era of 360 deals.
Absolutely, and it was still 360 deal era for sure.
Yeah, and that is, you think that's pretty much gone now, 360 deal era?
I think it's pretty much gone. I mean, I actually thought that typical 18-point royalty deals were gone, and then I heard about an artist the other day with pretty significant amount of clout and leverage who signed a traditional record deal with an 18-point royalty, and I was like, oh, that's kind of weird, but sometimes people want to take the check.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah, so I guess crazy. It's just a question of money now or money later, right?
Yep.
Interesting. So those were the key decisions, is basically betting on yourself,
yeah,
making
so.
Sure you had the product, but they already had a little bit of traction that they built without those big bets, which was helpful.
I mean, to be honest, the only one that really had traction was Posner. He was the most meteoric rise out of any of the artists that I worked with. You know, Sean had a following just because he had signed to Kanye, but you know, he was opening for Posner on shows around the country. And you know, that he needed a record because he had been signed to Def Jam for a while. You know, his budget was spent. He needed something to sort of be the catalyst to start moving that forward, because you know, the clock was ticking. Wale, we really built that from grassroots. He had a little bit of a following in DC at the time, just because he incorporated go-go music into his music, and that is, you know, really the soundtrack to DC at the time. But Mike was really the only one that had any sort of real traction going into working at radio. Capital cities were starting to build a fan base in, you know, a couple of random cities around the country. Funny enough, we went to Lima, Peru, multiple times before we did shows in New York. They built a massive following in Central America and South America. And I remember going into label meetings and telling people, oh, you know, the song went number one in Peru. And they're like, okay. And where now I think that people would look at something like that and say, oh, that's interesting. Similar thing happened to Mike Posner when he came out with I Took a Pill in Ibiza. That song was streaming off the charts in Scandinavia, and nobody cared about it. And I, you know, Mike and I were talking, I was like, this is going to be a big hit here, but nobody thought what happened over there could mean anything over here.
That's crazy. Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
There was an era
such a
when
more
happened.
Global business now. Sorry, Brad, what are you saying?
Sorry, no, I was just saying there, it used to be almost the opposite. Like rock bands like mine, you had to kind of break over in England before America, especially in the early 2000s. It was just a different game. You had to kind of have the NME flag waved and a rock and roll band overseas to even get attention over in America. So that's interesting. Like, you know, dance tunes, I would imagine that European, UK kind of club scene has always just been footprinted overseas more than it has been over here, where songs like, you know, Took a Pill in Ibiza, that totally rings to anyone in a club.
Yeah, but people don't think Scandinavia when they think Europe. They think, you know, the
France.
UK.
Maybe, you're right.
You know, maybe Germany, right? That's like the fourth largest music consumption country in the world, but nobody thinks, oh, it's you know, really popping over in Scandinavia. Although, like, you know, all of the best pop producers of all time for some reason come from that area. But
so true.
It really just didn't resonate with anyone.
You know, there's a little micro point, not to get us off course, but I was listening to Daniel Ek talk about why musicians are doing so well out of, you know, that part of the world, because for the most part, their basic expenses are covered. Their health insurance covered. They get a basic income, I think, you know, so they have like this level of, I can just be an artist pretty early on and not have to worry about like the basic things. So
that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to steal that, but I also think there's a counterpoint to make there, that the narrow experience of that life produces a narrow lane of music.
Yeah.
Right. Because I mean, great art comes from great struggle.
Usually does. Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean,
I think there's a counterpoint to that as well.
Yeah. I think the struggle piece, I mean, it's very obvious, and, you know, rhythm and blues started from struggle, and hip hop started from struggle, and those are, you know, hip hop is the biggest genre in the world now. So,
yep.
There's something to that vibe that definitely connects to that, to the, I don't know, maybe the suffering everybody feels in some way or another. Mm-hmm. So beyond the music business, you're an entrepreneur too. You've done a couple ventures. Was that during the music time, or you're still doing music in some way or another, right? Or are you just doing the wealth management stuff now?
No, I do wealth management. I have a number of music clients, and I've built a niche helping people go through the process of selling their catalogs, and, you know, the only goal being to manage the proceeds afterwards. So yeah. I still kind of have one toe in the music industry, mm-hmm. but my day to day is, you know, stewarding people's wealth. But in terms of the entrepreneurial stuff, you know, I think it really started at a young age when I got my first summer job, but beyond that, in college, promoting parties. And then after that, you know, starting my own management company out of my bedroom. And then my first sort of foray into actually starting, you know, a venture was back when I was managing Mike and we were working the song to radio. The thing that kept coming up was, well, he's got all these online fans, but like, that doesn't mean anything in the real world. It sounds so insane to say that right now, right?
Yeah.
And so I wanted to figure out a way to bridge that. And so I built a radio request widget that geo-targeted fans, you know, when they clicked the link, and allowed them to tweet or Facebook post a request to the radio station, the pop or rhythm station nearest them, saying, hey, at, you know, 102.7 KISS FM, please play at Mike Posner Cooler Than Me. Like, that's my jam. And so we started like flooding social feeds early on with, you know, tweet requests.
That's genius.
And then I thought, well, I should do this for other artists. So we built that out. It ended up getting some traction, but it was really an idea. It wasn't a business.
Yeah.
And then funny enough, like 10 years later, I'm listening to the Stretch and Bobbito podcast and they're interviewing Chance the Rapper. And he starts describing this business that he started. And I'm like, wait, I did that 10 years ago. So he started this thing called Rapper Radio, which was literally the exact same thing. I reached out to tell him, don't waste your time. But, you know, it's just funny that the idea came up again.
Then, you know, it's funny because ideas are, they have that way of, you know, if you're first, you might be a little bit ahead of it or whatever, or maybe, yeah. You know, some ideas just need time to get in.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned something that we see a lot of lately, which is selling catalog, right? And so yep. Selling your catalog at some point, you see big companies like Hypnosis and you've got Spirit Music raising mega funds to buy assets, mm-hmm. books of assets. And then, you know, they just look at them like an 8%, you know, yield on their value over time, and that's how they're justifying it. And then the use cases of music online are exploding too and will continue, so it's a pretty interesting bet. What's your take on that world, and what do you see being sort of closer to it with the artists?
I think it's really the ultimate form of agency, but I think what it's done is it's exposed the cracks in the artists' understanding of their foundation, because they've never cared more about the terms of their deal than they do now when mm-hmm. they're trying to go and sell their assets. So I think what a great sort of byproduct of all this is that you have people questioning more, you know, what is this deal that I signed? Is there anything to do about this right now? You have artists asking a lot more questions. I can't tell you how many artists who have come to me and said, I finally read Don Passman's book and I'm horrified by the decisions I've made, you know, over the past 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
So I think ultimately it's bringing more of this, more transparency to the forefront and allowing people hopefully to make better decisions. And I also think that the confluence of that with, you know, Kanye West tweeting out his recording agreement, or something like the Record Deal Simulator. I don't know if you've seen that sort of went viral a couple of months ago. Mm. I think people are starting to realize just how bad the music business is, which
yeah.
I think more scrutiny will lead to better, you know, better transparency.
Mm-hmm. You know, do you think that, so the music business is, there's clearly some very bad, like loan agreements is kind of what it is. And you get the asset too, along with it. And it's pretty, do you think though that without like I don't know. I'm not trying to justify the shitty deals, because I'm not, but you know, there always needs to be a place for like a business person to commercialize the art, and that's hard work too, you know? And I think where the industry is going is more of a fair agreement. Like, what can you work on that's fair, so both sides are able to win, and you know, you're not taking the future out of an artist's mm-hmm. art, you know, because you get a window of time as an artist to make great art. And you know, you're not going to like finish that record deal and then go start another band that's just as big. It just doesn't happen, you know?
Right.
What do you think that the future of the business is? Like, over the next 5 years, what do you think the trends are going to be that are going to make a big difference for artist's career, or for just, you know, consumption?
I think for better or for worse, you're going to see artists doing deals directly with streaming services once they're out of their recording agreements.
Yeah.
I think if I had to guess, that will be a trend that fizzles out pretty quickly, because if the whole point is to, you know, get rid of the middleman, but part of doing that is signing what amounts to basically a work for hire, I think that people are going to start looking at that and be like, wait a minute, this actually doesn't make any sense. Why am I giving up these, you know, government mandated royalty rights that I have to my music just for a big check? This is basically the same thing as a record deal. But in my opinion, the streaming companies have a very hard time reaching any sort of, you know, efficiency scale, because as they grow, so does their underlying cost of paying out royalties. It's not like, you know, a manufacturing company that once they get their, you know, manufacturing line running 24 hours a day, all of a sudden they've like reduced their costs significantly.
They can bring costs
down, right? Yeah. As streaming becomes bigger, well, so does the pot of royalties that you have to pay out, which mm-hmm. is, I think, why you see Spotify betting so heavily on podcasting. In addition to the fact that you can do native advertising in podcasts, I make the joke that, you know, you're not going to stop in the middle of like Post Malone's new song and like hear a commercial. That's just not going to work.
You never know.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for better or for worse, for whatever reason in music, people have been conditioned to have everything available to them at any given time, but only listen to a very small fraction of that. Whereas in, you know, streaming video content, nobody gets mad but nobody like throws a fit when some random movie is not on Netflix. It's just, you know, it's part of the business, right?
Yeah.
So I think that if streaming companies want to be all things to all people, you know, there's not many more pivots that they can do other than neutering the power of the catalog, which is essentially the, you know, what the power of the labels, the power of the labels still have at this point. Beyond that, I think that, you know, I think that most of the majors, from what I can see, are getting into essentially just the distribution business, because there's no reason why, you know, a CD Baby or a DistroKid should be competing with Universal. You know, Universal needs to meet the artists where they're at. And maybe for one artist, it makes sense to just upload their stuff directly, but maybe for another artist, they need, you know, all the other stuff that comes along with it. So I think you're going to see a lot more, just a lot more DIY.
Yeah. And that's what Cobalt's an interesting company in that respect, yeah. Where, you know, they have all
of Cobalt.
It. Yeah. It's a cool model.
If I was an artist, I would sign a publishing deal with Cobalt. And it's not a coincidence that Max Martin, Dr. Luke, and Mike Caron all have their deals at Cobalt.
Huh.
That's really cool.
What do you think about technology? I mean, it's come up a bunch on this conversation already, which is, you know, in 2006, you guys were looking at the internet. So what's the forward thinking vision in your eyes right now? Where do you think music's going to need to be or will be, and people should pick bets on?
You know, I think a lot of these, VR things, it's a crapshoot. The gaming stuff is a crapshoot. It's somebody's going to win, but I don't know if it's clear who that is at this point. I don't think that streaming concerts are ever going to replace, you know, live, you know, the live business.
Yeah.
But I do think that in the near future, when touring does come back, you're going to see a lot of people initially tripping over one another when, you know, tours get back on the road, and you're going to have this race to get shows out. And what that's going to do is it's going to force people, you know, who are already having to make decisions what concerts they want to see on a regular year, but forget about in a year where everything's being, you know, concentrated in a couple months, and ticket prices are already really high. I think what you're going to see is, I think you're going to see the most change in the ticketing world, if I had to guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, the gaming stuff's already happening. The VR stuff's already happening. Ticketing to me is the albatross in the music industry and the music business.
Yeah.
It's the least transparent.
I mean, don't you part of think the music it's industry. Gonna even be Paul McCartney at Petco Park, but if it sells out and you can't be there, buy the virtual ticket like you are there and watch the show online.
Yeah, I mean, potentially, but that's just an ancillary business right there. To me, the ticketing business is a problem. I compare it to the healthcare and health insurance, you know, debacle in America.
Okay.
Because you have the venue, the ticketing, the management company, and the tour deal all controlled by one entity, right? And one is wagging the tail of the other. And, you know, when stuff goes on sale, how do you know that row G seats 1 and 2 actually made it in the primary inventory? You have no idea. There's no transparency about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like,
I mean, it's a known fact that inventory skips the primary market, right? Because they want to experience the upside of the secondary market. That's not transparent. And I think that as artists, you know, take more and more control over their business, you know, I hope they're going to get more savvy on how to participate in that, but also how to track that as well. I think that's a huge problem. Mm-hmm. In addition, you know, something like 30% of all tickets go unsold. Mm-hmm. And I think that the future is making sure that doesn't happen, and giving people the opportunity to, if they can move tickets, then they're part of the solution, because there's no reason why if some, you know, an eighth grader in Columbus, Ohio has the influence at his school, that he should not be participating in the upside of, you know, helping move 50, 21 Pilots tickets on the next tour. Why is that only Ticketmaster's job?
That's interesting. Yeah. Using crowdsourcing, making sure that business is optimized. Yeah. You mentioned the gaming space. How do you, and you said that it's already kind of there. In which way do you think that can grow? And where do you think the entry point right now is? Where do you think it's like fully
Wild, Wild West?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think virtual experiences are, you know, we're so at the beginning of that. My, you know, fun fact, my first assistant 10 years ago when I was managing Wale and then Mike Posner was a young man named David Stromberg, and he now manages Travis Scott. You know, careful what you wish for, but he put the whole Fortnite thing together. And I think what was really interesting about that is, you know, Travis made more money for doing less work than he ever had before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would joke that, you know, being an artist is not as fun as it looks, because it's really not a scalable business, right? You're only, you know, people talk about the time value of money, but when you're an artist, it's really the money value of time. And, you know, you have hit records. Sure. Those are getting streamed at a given moment, a million times around the world, and you're getting paid off of that, but your time can only be monetized so efficiently. And so seeing something like what David and Travis did with Fortnite that didn't require anything from Travis, and having that be one of the most profitable things he's ever done. I mean, to me, figuring that out is the future.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah. That was Fortnite. And then there was the Roblox version one, which was Lil Nas X. Mega. Which was an even bigger one. I think that was 35 million people in attendance for that one. But clearly that's like a tip of the pyramid style scenario. Not like they couldn't have concurrent concerts going on to anybody in the world. That's the interesting part of digital? Is it, you know, there could be, just like in any given day in Los Angeles, there's probably 20 different big concerts going on.
Yeah.
And all of those people have different people who like that kind of music and don't like the other. So the internet's going to be like that, where there's concurrent things going on in that same stage. But it's a super interesting space.
But my question that I'll pose to you guys is, sure, have you ever watched a streaming concert and thought, man, that was awesome?
No, not at all. Because the 2D the 2D experience of it, it's just, and we've talked about this on the podcast, is like, what's really holding back those experiences is the hardware, the access to hardware, right? And you kind of have to have everybody have a VR headset with haptic sort of reaction. I mean, there's no replacement for 50 subwoofers that like pound you with sound at a live concert, right? And so that experience, they're just so far from it. Like even in the theaters, they try to like put smell into the air in some theaters, and they like shake your seat, and like, I guess that's kind of cool, but it's just, you're not there, right?
Yeah. And I also think the bigger problem is that most artists' shows don't translate outside of being there. Mm-hmm. Like really, when you think about all the great concert DVDs of all time, Stop Making Sense, right? That's my favorite. David Byrne is he's an impresario. He's a mastermind of this kind of stuff. I mean, you saw with the Broadway, the Broadway show that he did last year, something like that, I think, can translate. But going to an EDM show and watching that online, it's like, I mean, why even bother, kind of, you know?
It's like those types of things are like, you end up just having little satellites and then having a party while that show's going on.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
All that said, like, if, you know, being that you've been around artists all this time and you've seen the landscape change since you started, what would your advice be for a new artist that's starting out and saying, okay, I'm trying to, you know, maybe I've got something going and maybe I've just got something in my bedroom. What would the steps that you think have the highest value, where would you think they needed to get to first?
I have a few like catchphrases that I use related to this stuff when artists come to me for advice. The first thing that I say is, people have done less with more and more with less. So many artists, and even just, you know, up and coming managers, et cetera. It's like, yeah, we just need a budget for, digital marketing. And I'll be like, okay, like, what does that mean to you? Yeah. And they can't like explain, right? But it's this exterior, external force that's preventing them from being successful, that they don't have this, right? And the other thing that I'll say is that just because you can doesn't mean you should. So many artists I know, don't have that sort of perfectionist mentality that says, you know, this song right now is a 6, but I can make this a 10 and I'm going to make it a 10. And even if I fail at that, it's still going to be a 9. That's how you get, that's how you get so much garbage. And that's really what brings down connoisseurship, in my opinion, because when all things are created equal and something is considered good just because it has a lot of views, people then start confusing views with actually being good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they say, I can put this out now because this is gonna get a lot of views, but that doesn't mean it's good. And that's my biggest sort of gripe with contemporary music, is you really just have a bunch of people saying, well, I can throw this online right now and what's the worst that could happen? Mm-hmm. I often joke about Soulja Boy, his first single, whatever it was called, Soulja Boy Tell Him or something like that, Crank That, whatever. They never bothered mixing a proper version of that song. So every time you hear that song, it's the worst version of that song. Like, go listen to it on Spotify right now and you're like, wow, I can't believe this sounds this bad. Well, it's because he recorded it through like a headphone on his laptop and that's what got popular and they didn't want to sort of mess with it.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah. you know, and you see, you mentioned TikTok earlier, and I we talked to a lot of artists, and they're like, yeah, you know, all I need is, you know, you could see how like the most certified song ever is Old Town Road, and it's evolution from being a short version to the remix one that made it to the radio because it needed to be long enough for that format, and they needed to add in some, you know the story, but all that TikTok ends up being is this moment in a song, right? And it's like one hook that takes off, but it's really is building careers. And so like, and if you actually just go and look at the craft of the song and the structure of it, it's pretty interesting that the ones that are making it on, you know, top 10 TikTok tracks are just repeats of the same part of music. So, you know, like the evolution of music format's always been based on whatever the format you listen to it on. So like, that's a natural progression. But it doesn't, it's like, but then that's like, you're chasing lightning in a bottle really for, I'm going to make a TikTok song. Doesn't really work that way, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's a, there's, you know, but that's the music business has always been a little bit of a, here's a mirage.
Yeah. But I think when you reward that, it, you know, people then lean into it. I personally think TikTok is one of the worst things to happen on the internet, like in the history of the internet. And there's been a lot of bad things on the internet. I liken it to somebody bending over in the mirror naked and looking up the ass of YouTube. That's how I refer to TikTok. It's like the most postmodern self-referential medium that I've ever seen in my life. And I think it's going to, for years to come, for generations to come, it's going to change the way people express themselves, both like when the camera's on and when the camera's off, you know, because it's made micro expressions such a big part of life.
Yeah.
Where that was never a thing before. Mm-hmm. And another analogy that I make is on TikTok is that you have to love what you hear immediately. And if you don't, it's not good. And I think we all know, probably, you know, generally speaking, our favorite songs, we probably didn't like them when we first heard them.
Yeah. They got to grow on you a bit.
Yeah. And so what you have is like, there's this book called The 22 Immutable Laws of Branding. It's a great book. And there's a chapter in there about the
Jack Trout.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a Pepsi in there. I mean, a chapter in there about the Pepsi challenge. And then this commercial marketing, you know, assault that Pepsi did on Coke back in the, I think, early 90s, they filmed these blind taste tests and the Pepsi won. And that was the Pepsi challenge, right? But what they failed to mention was that the first sip of Pepsi tastes better than the first sip of Coke. But the entire can of Coke tasted better than the entire can of Pepsi. To me, that's what TikTok is. And I think that's what a lot of contemporary music is now that everything is on demand. If you click through something on a playlist and you don't like it within 5 seconds, well, okay, next song. Oh, this is great. And it's, so you're basically choosing, you know, sugar over vegetables, right? You're choosing, you know, Skrillex over, you know, Massive Attack or something like that.
Yeah.
And it, I think it just dumbs down and dulls connoisseurship. And this is why we are where we're at.
I think that, you know, what I like about art though, is you're going to find usually this, those types of things create counterculture movements, right? To, hey, fuck that. We're going to make a song that's 5 minutes and we think it's cool. And so does everybody else who thinks deeply about music, you know, and hopefully that'll always be a part of pushing the art form, you know, versus like not relying on the media. So like, I'm just a believer in that.
But think about what the internet and blogs did for music versus what TikTok is doing for music, right? You know, people coming out with mixtapes and, you know, stuff like Danger Mouse and, you know, the Black Album that he did where he used the Beatles samples. Remember that, you know?
Like, yeah,
nobody's really doing that anymore, right?
Yeah,
it's like just bottom of the barrel.
It's very similar to the ad business too, with clickbait and headlines, and you know what we happen, or then all of it's happened in our political system, and it's all very much like who can yell the loudest, you know, mm-hmm. not necessarily with substance. Well, that's super interesting. Dan, I mean, we could wrap now. I think what's great about what we talked about. And so is there anything else you would throw in for a musician? So like focus on quality is what I hear.
I can throw in a couple other things.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I think the biggest mistake, and this has been a mistake, you know, since forever ago, is trying to emulate something that's working for somebody else, and not sort of doing you 110%.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the biggest mistake that most artists make. They see something working for someone else and they're like, okay, well, like, let me see if that works for me. And that's how you get, you know, Volcano and Dante's Inferno at the same time. But, you know, it's how you get so much stuff that is so similar.
Mm-hmm.
Where if I were becoming an artist, you know, I'd be putting together a handbook on what it means to be me as the artist, right? I would clearly identify what my artist persona is. There's a book called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield that talks a lot about the persona and being a professional artist. And I think that a lot of people end up being kind of amateur artists. And then one day they need to rise to the occasion of being a professional artist and they don't have the tools to do that. I think identifying what your values are, what your brand is, what you stand for, you know, once you do all those things and you set a framework for yourself being an artist, you know, the other stuff kind of fills in. And, you know, sort of to that effect, I think you look at someone like The Weeknd when he first came out, the mystique that was there, the world that he played in, the world he exists in was so, it was so rare for the time that people really like sort of grabbed onto that. And I think you see it kind of like with Future a little bit when he first came out. But the ones that build a world are the ones that win, in my opinion. And I think the ones that kind of just be like, okay, well, like this is our song, you know, and talk too much between the songs when they're playing. It's like, okay, like I kind of want there to be a little mystique. I think 21 Pilots like absolutely nails it in that respect. I mean, the world they built for themselves and their fans. To the point where they can go away for a year and be mm-hmm. as popular or more popular when they come back, you know, really speaks volumes to the thought and planning that goes on behind it.
That's
what's crazy is I saw that band in Argentina. We played Lollapalooza. Right after them, and I, you know, never really heard of them. This is 2018.
Lollapalooza.
It was Lollapalooza. Yeah. And I was absolutely blown away by that band, that how they had a drum riser that came out with the drummer and then it disconnects and it crowd surfs amongst the crowd with a drummer playing and they bring them back to the stage. It was one of the most entertaining spectacles I've ever seen.
Yeah. I think people underestimate, you know, the notion that somebody could be seeing you for the first time at any given moment. And mm-hmm. you could potentially win a fan for life at that show versus, well, I'm playing for my fans, you know, like I'm playing for my fans. I'm playing for the people that know everything. Mm-hmm. I think there's a clear line in the sand on artists who deliver, you know, a show, an experience, you know, an album, whatever the case may be, where you can put that on, show that to a person, bring a person to that show, and they walk away and be like, you know what? I'm not going to necessarily listen to this music, you know, in the car, but man, that show was like awesome.
Mm-hmm.
There's like that number of artists that do that is you know dwindling by the day.
Absolutely.
There's an element of a mystique that you brought up, which Brian and I talk about a lot, missing, you know, like this sort of it's not like a distance, it's like it's just what was created so well around an artist's world and you wanted to be in it sucked you into it, and like social media is like this open door to the bathroom of their mm-hmm. life. You know, it's like you just see too much and it's, you can't unsee some things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And,
I mean, I used to find like the artists that I like by reading the credits. You read the Stones and Beatles, additional musicians, Leon Russell, who's Leon Russell? You go back and you hear his catalog and realize he's penned tunes for all these people now and fans with them. And yeah, it was like you had to dig to get into this world of theirs, you know? And there's just something like when I first saw Keith Richards in this, you know, my parents got me into guitar lessons and piano lessons as a tiny little kid. I hated it. It was like forceful, you know, you have to learn this Air Supply song. I'm not into that. Then I gave it up. But then years later, my older sister's cool boyfriend comes over and puts this VHS in of a Stones concert. And I see Keith Richards and how he's playing like A chords with just one finger instead of how you technically learn it with three fingers. I'm like, this lazy kind of rock thing, I dig this. I want to be this guy. That doesn't really exist that much anymore.
It really doesn't. It really, really doesn't. And I think it's really unfortunate that I would say by and large, young people today care less about the music that came before them more than any other generation of young people prior to this, which is just so weird because they literally have every song available to them at their fingertips. I mean, if Spotify was around, you know, when I was in high school and I went to boarding school outside of Boston, I'd take the T into Boston, go to Tower Records on Newbury Street and, you know, spend all my money on, you know, random CDs. And one day I remember seeing at the counter, oh, they have this album by this group called Black Star. And I'm like, oh, let me check this out. Most Def and Tilib Kweli. And it completely changed my life. Mm-hmm. You know, that discovery is really only happening with new music, unless something like the TikTok video of Dreams happens or a sync happens. And, you know, you find these old gems, like, you know, I think a great example is somebody like Ned Doheny, right? You listen to Ned Doheny and you're like, oh, that's Rex Orange County, right? And a Rex Orange County fan would really like Ned Doheny, but there's no algorithm that exists where Spotify is going to deliver Ned Doheny to a Rex Orange County fan. And that's a shame that
they're not putting old with the new. They're only going new with new.
New with the new. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just think there's a lot that that people miss out on. I think there was formerly a collective consciousness and a collective cultural memory around music that you know, has really been diluted considerably in the last 10 years, where you could reference a group or a song and be like, yeah, I've heard of them, or yeah, I know one of their songs, to now it's like, who? What? Mm-hmm. It's bizarre to me.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting
time. That was a tangent. Sorry.
Interesting time. This show is about tangents.
It is. It really is. Real quick, just on a side note, if you go into a school in Massachusetts, I recorded at a studio out in, is it Manchester?
It's North Shore.
It was called Fort Apache.
Cool.
Then it later became Camp Street Studios.
I've never heard of it.
It's a epic studio. They mixed like the first Radiohead album there. Cool. It got on the map. And then from there, a lot of the Boston bands like Belly, Pixies, all started recording their records there. But, Cambridge, that's what it is.
Oh, it's Cambridge. Okay. Mass. Got it. Yeah.
So, just was awesome to spend a couple weeks in that city, even when it was snowing, and I'm a California boy.
Yeah. Boston, Boston has a great musical history and has actually a great hip hop history that, you know, really didn't get its shot for a number of years just because the city was so racist. But, you know, Guru from Gangstar is from Boston. Mm. You know, the Source magazine, which was, you know, really the first hip hop magazine that really defined culture, was started in a dorm at Harvard University. I mean, there was like, you know, Ed OG and the Bulldogs was, you know, first Boston artist to be signed to a Mercury major label, Mercury Records. You know, Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, Boston, New Kids on the Block, Boston, you know, New Edition in Boston. It has a very House of Pain's not from Boston.
Oh, dang it.
That is like to wear the Celtics jerseys because they're Irish.
Yeah, right. Well, you're a wealth of wisdom, Dan. It's really been great to chat with you. We could keep doing this for hours.
Let me know when you
come back
you need,
again.
When somebody drops out and you need to fill a spot, let me know.
All right.
Sounds good. Cool.